ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. It's Monday, the 3rd of November. I'm Andy Park, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, Optus faces the music in a Senate inquiry over 000 failures linked to three deaths. And will a legendary Tasmanian sailor's non-stop round-the-world solo record fall to his very own son?
It's 50% sailing, 50% psychological. Now, Tristan can certainly sail the course. I believe he's got that wish to do it as well, which will carry him through probably the harder or the lonelier times.
Nationals party leader David Littleproud argues there's a cheaper, better way to meet international emissions obligations and not at the cost of Australian households. His party's decision to formally ditch support for net zero by 2050 has put them out of step with their coalition partner, the Liberals. According to some analysts, the move is going to make an already difficult job much harder for the coalition at the next election. Tanya Dendrinos reports.
A 2021 commitment for Australia to reach net zero emissions by 2050 abandoned.
We can't get there. This is the thing. There's no country that is going to get to net zero by 2050. And if they do, they will destroy their economy.
Nationals leader David Littleproud declared the target is tearing regional Australia apart. The decision was agreed upon yesterday at a federal council and was one which had already been taken by state and territory branches.
We still have a responsibility to continue to reduce emissions and we want to live up to that, but we believe there's a cheaper, better, fairer way to do that, living up to international commitments, but putting at the fore of that affordable energy for Australians and for industry, looking at adaptation, investing back into the environment.
The idea is to peg Australia's emissions to the OECD average. The Nationals' proposed model would set out to reduce emissions by 30 to 40% by 2035, well below the federal government's commitment of 62 to 70%. But its coalition partner is still working through its net zero policy position. Shadow Minister for Energy and Emissions Reduction Dan Tehan says the Liberal Party will continue working with the Nationals.
There is a hell of a lot that we have in that is similar, hell of a lot that is similar. And so we'll continue that process. I look forward to having further discussions on the fine detail of what they've decided over the weekend, and we'll do that hopefully this week.
But he says the Liberal Party won't be rushed into making a policy decision he described as critically important for Australia's future.
The most important thing is to get it right. It's a real challenge, energy policy. It underpins everything that's essential to our economy. And we've got to be able to get back to that focus on affordability first. That has to be an absolute key. And then we've also got to make sure we're doing our bit when it comes to emissions reduction.
Liberal MP Melissa McIntosh, however, says she won't support a commitment to net zero by 2050.
I'm backing my community on their position, which is that they don't support net zero, but we do need to find a pragmatic energy solution.
Asked today when people can expect to see their power bills come down, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese pointed the finger back at the opposition.
What has occurred on power prices is the product in part of the dysfunction and chaos that's been there of the coalition. 24 out of 28 coal-fired power stations announced their closure. They had no plan to do anything other than fight each other, and that's continuing today. What we've done is put a cap on gas and coal prices.
Former Labor strategist Cos Samaras is now director of political consultancy Redbridge.
It's probably a manifestation of a type of politics which is strangling the coalition and strangling its electoral chances for the future. And that is a type of politics that may bounce really well in the US or the UK or other countries, but is really almost electoral poison in our big cities here.
He says the move will make it even more difficult for the coalition to win back seats at the next election.
The Liberal Party's got a really big problem now, and that is the politics which may work in National Party electorates no longer work in the large cities of our country. It's within these large cities where the coalition needs to win seats, where the Liberal Party in particular needs to win seats and needs to start talking to an emerging and dominant generation of voters who will be in excess of 50% at the next election.
Pollster Cos Samaras there from Redbridge Group, ending that report by Tanya Dendrinos. The spring selling season is well and truly underway, but as the housing crisis continues, first-time buyers feel like they are, once again, being priced out of the market. And it's investors who are finding confidence in this current market. National house prices rose 1.1% in October and have increased by 6.1% over the past year. With a November rate cut seemingly off the table tomorrow, one expert believes house prices will continue to rise into the new year. Nazim Kadem reports.
You can literally walk on in, enjoy after you settle, and enjoy the property and create those priceless family memories that you have been longing for.
Every weekend across Australia, properties go under the hammer and aspiring homeowners try to enter the market.
At 1,117,000, we're selling, and we're sold. Congratulations and well bought to you, folks.
At this recent Melbourne auction, some first home buyers are feeling defeated after the final hammer, while those looking to invest remain hopeful.
We've been to a few auctions now and there's so many people bidding and a lot of investors. So, yeah, we know that there's a lot of competition between, yeah, first homeowners or people wanting to upsize or even, yeah, investors. There's a lot of competition.
Essentially, I'm looking to buy an older, rundown home, and with the Melbourne market prices driving up, I feel like there's some really big opportunities.
I think it's a good time right now because the interest rates start to decrease and a lot of people are jumping into the market. And if you don't do this right now, you will be regretful.
Come through, mate. Just choose off.
Ray White real estate agent Jack Rickard believes now is the time to buy in Melbourne.
With the interest rates, first home buyers are really keen to enter the market with some new schemes and that sort of thing. And investors are definitely looking to buy in Melbourne because every capital city around Australia has had a second boom since COVID and Melbourne hasn't seen one yet.
National house prices are up 1.1% in October and 6.1% over the year. Perth is leading the monthly gains, followed by Brisbane, Darwin and Adelaide, the regions, Melbourne and Sydney. The combined regions saw a 1% gain over October and 7.5% lift over the year.
So we've actually created a system where it's more viable for some people to buy a home, not because they're going to live there, but to buy it to grow their wealth.
Eliza Owen is the head of research at property data group Cotality.
You've got investors more active in the market than first home buyers just because of affordability constraints and the fact that investors in the market may have a bit of equity under their belt already if they own investment properties.
She says lower interest rates and government incentives for first home buyers will continue driving people back into the market.
It seems that a November rate cut is off the table, but that doesn't rule out further rate cuts in 2026, and it doesn't rule out further price rises for the rest of this year. We're definitely expecting a pretty strong result for this year, potentially around 6 or 7%.
But Eliza Owen believes gains next year may not be as high, with the hopes of at least one more interest rate cut, which could keep house prices elevated into the new year.
In 2026, we'll probably be getting to the end of that rate cutting cycle, and so potentially still price rises, but a softer pace than what we saw in 2025.
For these auction winners, the Australian dream of owning their own home has finally become a reality.
We understand how the market goes and then we feel like, I think this is a time that we need to move on and then get our first home.
A dream that many other buyers are still chasing.
Nazim Kadem reporting there. Optus is back in the spotlight over a catastrophic outage that left customers unable to contact 000. Three deaths are linked to the incident, and today senior executives faced a grilling at a Senate inquiry in Canberra. For more, I spoke a short time ago with reporter Peter Lusted from Parliament House in Canberra. Peter, why is this inquiry taking place in the first place?
Well, if you cast your mind back to September 18, there was a big network outage for Optus. It was an hours-long failure for it to realise that a routine system upgrade had disrupted 000 calls that service in Western Australia, South Australia, even parts of New South Wales, and that has since been linked to three deaths, including that of a baby. Now, we heard today some more information about Optus describing what went on and what the problem was. It said it was an unusual event where its core network was locked, or a core network network was effectively shut down, and it had the effect of 000 calls not working, but non-000 calls were working as normal, which led to some of the confusion. There was also a secondary effect from that, was that the normal ways that they pick up missed 000 calls is off the very piece of equipment that was locked up. So the team then had to find alternative methods of finding out about the missed calls, and that was what Optus has said was part of the reason behind some of the delays in communication further down the track.
Optus was accused of misleading the government over certainly some of the timing around these outages. What did the Senate inquiry hear?
What we have learnt is on the day, the 18th, there was a call made about 2:30 in the afternoon to the minister's office about the incident, and it was said that there was an outage and that 10 000 calls had been affected. It took some 24 hours later until Optus had actually updated that information that it was closer, it was actually 600. And there was a lot of questioning about this in the inquiry today. We saw Senator Henderson, Senator Sarah Hanson-Young, they were saying this was unacceptable. It got quite fiery, them saying that essentially there had to be updates along this 24-hour period. Here's Senator Varun Ghosh grilling the Optus CEO, Stephen Roo.
When you say the government was notified, given the content of that notification that we've just heard, that notification was inaccurate and potentially misleading?
Well, it was. Sadly, at that time, it certainly was inaccurate, in a sense that there were a lot more missed calls. And you asked, was there any information about fatalities? Well, clearly that came through later on in the day for us. So it wasn't. I wouldn't categorise it as misleading in the sense that it was information as we knew it at the time.
That was the Optus CEO, Stephen Roo, speaking. There was another timeline which we learnt as well today, a lot more information about. Now, this was further on the 18th, later at night. By this stage, Optus staff had been able to start contacting some of the people doing welfare checks, some of these people whose 000 calls were missed. The information we showed that around about 9:30 at night, these welfare calls had revealed that two people had died. From there, the Optus executive were informed around 12:25, so after midnight, and none of the executives saw that until the morning. So the next day, they then held meetings at Optus, but it took until 2:30 in the afternoon for Optus to inform about the two deaths to the ACMA, and then from there, the minister's office only learnt around about 4 o'clock, and that was because they were told by the ACMA, the Communications Authority. Now, we have heard a response from Optus. Stephen Roos said essentially the reason Optus has said it took so long to tell the government about all this information is it said it wanted to complete all its welfare checks so that it was able to tell the government the full picture when it did on the 19th in the afternoon, rather than give the government updates throughout the day. Now, we've also heard from Senator Sarah Henderson. Here's some of what she had to say outside of the Senate inquiry a short time ago.
We deserve answers. Three people died. This was a catastrophic outage. So there are many more things to uncover about what went wrong, because at the end of the day, this is a critical service and all Australians need to know that when they pick up the phone to dial 000, they will get the help they deserve.
Liberal Senator Sarah Henderson there, before her, Peter Lusted in Parliament House in Canberra. Thanks for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on the Listen app. Subscribe to the podcast for all of our stories. Just search for The World Today. In Ukraine, the battle for Pokrovsk is intensifying. If Russia captures the key eastern city, it would be the most important territorial gain in almost 2 years. Meanwhile, the head of Ukraine's prosthetics centre has told the ABC that battlefield injuries now often include patients who've lost multiple limbs. The reason for that is drone warfare. Nicole Johnston reports.
In the Black Sea port city of Odessa, emergency crews hose down a fire after another attack by a Russian drone. Further north, in the Ukrainian city of Pokrovsk, a knife-edge battle is underway. Russian troops entered it last week. Posting on social media, alongside war room photos, Ukraine's commander-in-chief, Oleksandr Stavnichi, says he's sent special operations forces into the city, writing, We are holding Pokrovsk. Losing it would be a major strategic blow for Ukraine. Across the border, Russia's war machine is in full gear. Its defense minister launched a new nuclear submarine in the port city of Severodvinsk, breaking a ceremonial bottle of what could be champagne on the sub, Russian defense minister Andrei Belousov.
This carrier of underwater weapons and robotic systems will enable us to successfully secure Russia's maritime borders and protect its national interests in various parts of the world's oceans. The vessel still has a series of sea trials to complete.
But the new ice-breaking patrol ship, the Ivan Papanin, has finished its trials and is ready to set sail. The defence minister is also here inspecting it. Part of Russia's ambitions to dominate the sea lanes of the Arctic. As the fighting ramps up, so do the casualties. The director of Ukraine's Unbroken National Rehabilitation Centre is in Australia, talking about the scale of injuries. Ole Bilyansky.
We talk about the more than 10,000 patients. It's a loss of lower limbs, but now we have the patients lost of upper limbs. It can be one limb or the two limbs. It is very specific patients because we never saw it before.
How has the nature of the injuries changed since the warfare became more dependent on drones?
In my opinion, now we have more difficult traumas than before because of drones, FPV drones attacks.
Tatiana Stavnichi is the president of one of Ukraine's largest aid organisations. She's also visiting Australia and says despite the war, Ukrainians are trying to get on with life.
What you see in Ukraine is that you see a desire to live. Yeah, and so you live through a night of bombings and then you get up in the morning and you see there's people cleaning up afterwards and people getting up, of course, a little tired, maybe some red eyes, and then going to work.
Tatiana Savnichi, the president of one of Ukraine's largest aid organisations, ending that report by Nicole Johnston. Democratic Socialist Zoran Mamdani remains the frontrunner in the New York mayoral race ahead of the former governor of New York State, Andrew Cuomo, who's running as an independent after Mamdani pipped him for the Democratic nomination. In some ways, it's a battle for the soul of the Democratic Party. And then there's a third candidate, a beret-wearing Republican, who runs his own anti-crime group that patrols the city streets, as Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
He certainly doesn't look or sound like most traditional establishment politicians in the United States, but that appears to be working in Zoran Mamdani's favour.
The name is Mamdani, M-A-M-D-A-N-I. You should learn how to say it because we got to get it right.
The 34-year-old is currently the front runner in this week's New York City mayoral race. He's on the brink of making history, on track to become the youngest mayor the city's had in a century, winning over voters by taking to the streets, shaking hands with taxi drivers, populist policies, and displaying a savvy social media campaign.
Hola, Nueva York! Ya pueden salir a votar y estoy pidiendo su apoyo. Por favor.
Merhaba. أنا اسمي زهران ممداني وأمرشح حالي ليكون العمدة الجديد في مدينة نيويورك.
Zoran Mamdani surprised and upset the Democratic Party establishment when he beat former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo for the mayoral candidacy back in June. After losing the Democratic nomination, Andrew Cuomo opted to run as an independent and has repeatedly criticised Mamdani's inexperience, including at an event in Queens at the weekend.
Homeowners in Queens, families who have children, they need public safety first.
While polls show Mamdani is leading Cuomo, the gap is narrowing. Adding to the uncertainty, there's a third candidate, Republican Curtis Sliwa, a talk show host who wears a signature red beret. He's a well-known New Yorker and founder of a group called Guardian Angels, a volunteer organisation that patrols city streets in an attempt to prevent crime. Sliwa has regularly condemned what he's described as migrant crime. Despite not having a chance of winning, Sliwa has refused to exit the race.
It's time for a new generation.
a new generation of Republican leaders.
New York Magazine columnist and former political candidate Ross Barkin worked with Zoran Mamdani when Mamdani managed his state Senate campaign in 2018.
He is a very talented, ambitious, and savvy person. He's someone who I always thought would have a political future.
Mamdani is young. He's both Muslim and an immigrant, born in Uganda. He became naturalised in the US in 2018. His background and left-wing socialist policies have been slammed by President Donald Trump, who's threatened to strip funding from New York if he's elected. But Ross Barkin says it's unlikely to be a deterrent.
There's no doubt that New Yorkers broadly are tired of Trump and have been for some time, and they want someone who seems like he's ready to take the fight to him.
Mamdani has won over voters with ambitious policies such as universal childcare, free city buses and rent freezes, but he's also been criticised that they are costly and unrealistic, and he's toned down some of his more socialist proposals, like disavowing his previous calls to defund the police. Ross Barkin says that will have swayed some, but not all, moderates.
There's a lot of voters who don't identify as socialists but are still willing to support him.
Early voting is now closed ahead of Election Day on Tuesday local time.
Bridget Fitzgerald. Tasmanian sailor Ken Gourlay's record time for circumnavigating the globe solo, non-stop and unassisted has stood for close to two decades. But it could be about to fall. And the threat is coming from close to home, as Ken's son Tristan prepares to set sail in his own pursuit of the title. Hayden Smith has more.
It was a hero's welcome for Ken Gourlay when he arrived back in Tasmania this morning.
How good can it get?
On a sunny Devonport morning back in 2007, Ken Gourlay arrived on the dock having set a new Australian record. The now 70-year-old had spent almost 180 days at sea. Covering nearly 23,000 nautical miles, he became the fastest Australian to sail non-stop, alone and unassisted around the world.
When I sailed it, I didn't know, when I left, I didn't know whether you enjoy or endure the sailing for that period of time. But since then, I did enjoy it. I could have sailed on, but once you see home, that's the big magnet then to come home.
Even back in 2007, Ken's son Tristan had his own eyes set on the same prize.
As I say, like father, like son, but I'll probably be a little bit bigger boat, a little bit faster, and with a little bit more knowledge that dad's gained now.
It's taken nearly two decades, but Tristan Gourlay is finally ready to make his own attempt.
Something I've always wanted to do, ever since a young kid sailing dinghies in the river here. I see it as one of the pinnacles of sailing, and it's a good, tough challenge, and I'd really like to give it a go.
Tristan Gourlay is no novice. He's competed in some of the world's toughest events, including the Sydney to Hobart and the Melbourne Osaka Cup.
I guess it's just the sheer length of time out on the water, and which is actually one thing I'm looking forward to, is that solitude for 150 days. It's not a sprint race, it's a long distance race. There's a lot of things can go wrong, so being as prepared as possible is sort of the best thing I can do.
Yeah, it's Cape Lewin.
Yeah.
And then you've got South East Cape. You've got South West Cape there.
No,
South East Cape.
The 46-year-old will leave Tasmania on his 16.4-metre yacht, Blue Moon 2, later this week. It's being loaded with more than 500 litres of water, fishing equipment and large stores of long-life food, as well as locator beacons in case he runs into trouble. Ken has been helping him prepare and offering plenty of fatherly advice along the way.
The most important thing, and I'm sure Tristan's got it, is the absolute wish to do it. You've got to want to do it. It's 50% sailing, 50% psychological. Now, Tristan can certainly sail the course. There's no problem. He has the skills, he has the ability, and I believe he's got that wish to do it as well, which will carry him through probably the harder or the lonelier times.
Ken Gourlay expects his record will finally fall.
People have said, oh, how do you feel about if Tristan does take your record off you? What could a man want better than his own son to do that? So, no, I'm quite happy.
For son Tristan, he's hoping that whatever happens, the record will remain in the family for a long time yet.
You know, you only have to miss things by this much, but, you know, I'd like to set as best record as I can and make it a little bit more of a challenge for the next person who's going to come along.
Sailor Tristan Gourlay ending that report by Hayden Smith and Alexandra Humphreys. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Andy Park.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Last month, when Donald Trump sat down with Anthony Albanese, they signed a landmark critical minerals deal. But we're also providing critical minerals to China, which it's using to build some of the most sophisticated weaponry in the world. Today, Angus Grigg on his Four Corners investigation. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.